Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the special Christmas week edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist and author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. Good to see you. I'm sorry we didn't get to record this episode last week back to back like you said we were going to, and that we ended up doing it at a different time.
How was your Christmas?
Oh, man, I can't even begin to tell you.
So here's what we're going to do, David. I went through our run lists for the last 52 weeks and found what I think are some of the best, or at least most fun stories.
The greatest hits. Covered.
Greatest hits. And I want to start with a story that requires a gentle handling for reasons that will become apparent. Under the heading of Best Sex Advice Story of the Year, that would go to Jennifer Siebel Newsom. She is, of course, the wife of Governor Gavin Newsom, and an email that was made public in 2022 by Harvey Weinstein's defense team shows that after she claimed, a year after she claimed, I'm sorry, 2 years after she claimed in 2005 that she had been raped by Harvey Weinstein, or at least sexually assaulted, 2 years later, 2007, she calls Harvey Weinstein and says, "Hey, my boyfriend is the mayor of San Francisco, and here's the deal. He's run into some trouble with regard to an extramarital affair." Our listeners will recall, David, that Newsom was alleged, and then he admitted to having had an affair with the wife of his chief of staff, a good, you know, lifelong friend of his. And his explanation for this subsequently, and now I'm skipping away from the email, his response to this when it became public was, "I have a battle with alcohol. It's not been good for me."
Right.
His staff indicated that he was going into rehab. That's right. He was going to go to a recovery center, a very famous one in San Francisco. And here's what's really interesting. So he kind of skips out, through this kind of theater of being a victim. "I'm a victim of alcoholism. I have a disease." And he goes into recovery. But then when he's running for governor in 2018, and the subject comes up during an editorial meeting, I believe it was with the Sacramento Bee, Newsom says, "No, there was no rehab. There was no alcohol trouble." So at one point, he uses it as an escape artist.
Now, but I thought he's also said, "There was, but I'm fixed."
Yeah, he did.
So there's, "I have alcoholism." Mm-hmm. There's, "I never had alcoholism." Mm-hmm. And there's, "I had it and it's cured."
That's correct.
But the most recent is, "It never happened."
The most recent in 2018 was he told the editorial board, Sacramento Bee, "It never happened." That just didn't happen. There was no rehab, he said. So, you know, this.
Did he say by chance, this, because I want to fine tune on this, did he say, "I don't remember, I was blacked out"?
"I was snorting coke so much at the time." No. Yeah. So here's what, you know, let's bring the story up to date. So part one of that story, this is what makes it so lovely. Despite the fact that behind it is a terrible, terrible accusation against an execrable human being named Harvey Weinstein. But what is illuminated in all of this is Newsom's, on again, off again love affair with the truth, or his changing notion of what constitutes truth. That's not a huge surprise to many people, but it is, you know, just important to chart so that we can know where the governor is. Today, the governor is at "There was no rehab." One can imagine that will be reinvented and repitched as necessary to be, "Yeah, there was absolutely rehab. I too am a victim, and I understand." Last Monday, December the 19th, an LA jury that heard testimony from Ms. Siebel Newsom declared that they could not reach a conclusion on her case, in which she had alleged that Weinstein sexually assaulted her in a hotel room. But that they found Weinstein guilty of several other charges. Here's how the New York Times put it. So this is just the update on the Siebel Newsom story. And that is that the verdict was delivered by jurors in L.A., the second sex crimes conviction for Mr. Weinstein, who was found guilty nearly 3 years ago of sexual assault and rape in New York. It serves as a backstop for keeping Mr. Weinstein in prison. That is, the L.A. decision will prevent Weinstein from getting out of jail free if a New York court decides after review that his conviction there was illegal. So, you know, just a fascinating and fun story for 2022. The second story that I wanted to talk about, David, was our worst California racists. And here I declare a tie. We have covered, I think, you know, two people or two institutions, two bodies as really endangered by their own racism. And the first of those is the LA City Council members. Everybody here will remember that three LA City Council members and a head of the LA Labor Federation of Labor met off campus in 2021. A recording of that of their conversation only became public a few months ago. And in this taped recording, everybody will know this by now, these Latino lawmakers in the LA City Council disparaged other ethnic groups and even members of who were Latino if they were born in, you know, say Chiapas or Oaxaca or something. I think it was Oaxaca. So they mocked their colleagues. They mocked a colleague who had adopted a black child as having purchased a purse, basically an accoutrement to make himself look more progressive. We have an update on that story this week, David. Gil Cedillo came out with an essay, a kind of a bizarre essay, Why I Did Not Resign.
This just came out earlier in December.
That's right. It was a week ago. Actually, December 12th, so now about 2 weeks ago.
By the way, I just wanted to point out, can you please read the first paragraph of his essay if you have it handy?
Well, you go ahead. I want to hear your
voice.
Most
people find the subject of redrawing political boundaries based on census data as boring as watching paint dry. In Los Angeles, though, a year-old illegally recorded conversation about the subject touched off a political firestorm. I love year old.
Yes.
These are people that have found 15-year-olds that were singing like a rap song that had the N-word in it, and then gone years and years later and said, you can't go to grad
That's
school.
Right.
All right. So this is 1 year old and these are grown adults. And second, illegally recorded.
Illegally recorded.
Okay. I don't sit around defending President Trump. Okay, I just don't. When he's wrong, he's wrong. And he's wrong on so many things. But all they've done is illegally obtained tax returns, and they've gone and they've used illegal methods of getting things all the time, and it's always the same.
That's right.
Who cares how we got it? We got it. You're
mm-hmm.
bad.
Mm-hmm.
And now this has been there, and it's right up there in the first sentence of this guy's piece. The year-old and illegal recorder are supposed to poison the well about what he's about to now say.
It is a remarkable piece of propaganda, and it's funny you mentioned Donald Trump, because that's who appeared in my brain as I was reading this. It is a very Trumpian document. So, for instance, he actually invokes Donald Trump's name as a cause, as a necessary cause for the off-campus meeting at which they disparage black people. It says here, the mission of this meeting, look, so let me back up. The mission of the meeting was to consider how voting maps informed by the U.S. Census had reduced Latino power. This is a crime, he says. This is, you know, everybody's missing the point that this is really urgent, that Latinos in the latest census lost seats or lost the electoral voting maps were changed so that Latinos would lose power in the LA City Council. This meeting was there to address that or redress that grievance. So why were the U.S. Census maps changed? Well, it has to be because they were fraudulent. Says who? Says Gil Cedillo. Our mission, he says, was especially difficult this cycle because former President Donald Trump and his lackeys intentionally intimidated immigrants so they wouldn't fill out their census questionnaires. I'd love to know the evidence for this. My former council district, quote, lost, I don't know why he has it in quotes, lost untold thousands of residents, and I've yet to see the media outrage for that crime against our Latino communities. So he's tried to twist this around the axle of Donald Trump, then tried to call it a crime. And of course, he would say he's speaking hyperbolically, but as a legal official, he ought to be a little bit more precise in his use of legal terms. Go ahead.
Is it factually correct? I don't remember. The person who said the worst stuff was the gal who resigned Biden forced her
That's
to.
Correct.
Did he say anything, Gil, or he just sat there?
Gil's a guy who says he didn't say anything to stop it.
Okay.
Bless you.
Okay, but my question is, did he say anything racist?
No, he says he did not.
Okay, and there's nothing on the tape that says he did.
I'm going to have to go back on it.
I got to say, this whole letter is really ridiculous.
Yes.
But I have no problem with him not resigning if he didn't say anything. I don't think you have to resign because you're sitting in the room. I don't think so.
I totally agree with you. But that's not his point.
But no, his point is, first of all, it's borderline. Look, people are pretty charged up because you got black and Mexican stuff going on, and the Mexicans have been mistreated more than the blacks.
That's right.
He's kind of doing a little black blaming.
A little bit.
But then he goes on to say, I was a delegate for Obama. I was a delegate for Jesse Jackson in 88. You should apologize for that. And he voted for Tom Bradley in 1980. Here's the thing. This is the way the works righteousness of the left works. That I have covered. Remember, don't ever forget for the rest of your life what Harvey Weinstein said the day after they finally broke the story at the New York Times about him being a serial sexual harasser. He wrote an op-ed saying, hey, look, I'm sorry if I've gotten a little handsy, and I apologize if anyone ever misconstrued things I said, but let's get back to the business of going after the NRA. That's what he wrote. Google it right now if you don't believe me. That's the op-ed he wrote.
That's great.
He thought for good reason. It happened to not work. That was the beginning of the Me Too movement. You know what? Actually, Harvey, we do want to get the guns and stuff, and you've been great, but you're kind of a creeper, and you're out.
Yeah.
But that's what these people think, is I can sit there and listen to abjunct racism because 30 years ago, I walked with Jesse Jackson. That is a weird way to view the world. And I'm telling you, this tokenism stuff, I will not have it. I will not let my kids say, I'm good. I've bought myself penance because I once voted for a Barack Obama.
That's right.
But this is the way these people think.
Well, it's such a wonderful piece, and you really should read it, dear listener. I'll put it in the show notes. Here's one of my favorite lines is he references both Trevor Noah and Lizzo.
Yeah, always get the pop culture.
That's right.
Get the cool kids.
My critics' warped zealotry isn't a sign of a growing movement for racial justice. It's a glaring problem. So his critics are the problem in American society. Why? Because they are so sensitive about language, he says. Satirist Trevor Noah, I'm coming back to the story that he wrote, satirist Trevor Noah recently came to the defense of singer-songwriter Lizzo, who used the phrase spaz out in a song. When told the term was offensive to disabled people, she re-recorded the song with new lyrics. Nothing, however, satisfied her critics. We're living in a world, Noah observed, where people have gotten used to parading as the most virtuous or righteous person. I mean, my gosh, David, this is his side. He owns this. There is a kind of collective guilt here. He is both using his identity to protect himself and then using the language police who are always protecting identity, like spaz out, Lizzo, Trevor Noah. You know, when it comes, oh my God, I'm exaggerating.
Spaz out is bad? Why?
Because it refers to spastic, and people who have spasms, epilepsy might be considered a spasm. When I was in England back in the early 80s, when good old Margaret Thatcher was in power and I was a communist, they actually had little collection boxes on the street of iron kids, you know, painted to look like little kids with a hole in their head where you could put coins. And the kids were, you know, abominably disfigured. They had the, you know, crazy joints going on, and they had a little hole in their head for the coins, as I say, so you could collect money. It said, give money to the spastics. And I found this hysterical. Now I would be ridiculed as somebody who makes fun of epilepsy, my dear friends. Mm. So, such a great story. The second great racist story, of course, is really got to be the Reparations Committee and its work in California. This is a group of people who have looked at all the recent policy failures that have made life worse for the poor. You could go from climate to, you know, giving money away to black women who have babies, but only black women who have babies, not white women, not Asian women, not a Latino woman. All of these programs that were supposed to help African-American people, and yet African-American metrics look really bad. African-American performance on health, on education, on job performance is really bad in California and getting worse at a time when the Democrats are fully in charge of everything in the state. They run the state. And their best explanation for this is, it's got to be racism, got to be slavery. Not just racism of the sort of diurnal kind that happens, you know, once or twice a day that you are accustomed to seeing and you find repellent, like the racism of the LA City Council. No, they go back to slavery in the 19th century, which of course doesn't exist in California in the 19th century, at least in any systematic way. It is banned by law, both under the Mexican government, which abolished it, I think, in the 1830s, I want to say, and in California law when the state was granted statehood in 1850. We could go on about reparations, but I think you get the picture. Trying to distinguish who truly is a descendant of a person who was held in bondage in the 19th century became too difficult, so it then became the definition of being black and a victim of slavery became, can you prove you were the descendant of any black person who was here in the U.S. in the 19th century? You don't even have to have been in California at the time.
I think you're right that that is one of the highlight stories. What's interesting, too, about it being a 2022 story is it's been kind of in the makings for several years. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Sometimes you think some of these bad ideas will kind of fade away. Mm. You remember monkeypox, Will?
Well,
I noticed that was not in your list.
It is on my list.
Where? I didn't see it.
Emergency of the year.
Yeah.
You want to skip right there right now? Let's do it.
But what I was going to say is a lot of the emergency of the year story kind of went away.
There you go.
And what's his name? Your friend you like.
Scott Wiener.
Scott Wiener said how it was really offensive to him that they were talking about banning like orgies at bathhouses when really, you know, we needed to be free to
Yeah, it wasn't even a ban that he was objecting to. It was messaging that suggested that the disease could be reduced if people would stop, if gay men would stop having sex with one another.
Specifically in a highly promiscuous and non-monogamous context.
That's exactly right.
Right. So I'm not being derogatory when I reference the orgies and bathhouses. That was the behavior being targeted as like, hey, let's maybe wait till this virus dies down a little to get back to some of that. And he was like, nope, and so I was going to use as an example of some stories just sort of fade away.
Yeah.
Like a week after we covered that, I didn't hear a lot of people saying like, look, we got, where is our right to have non-monogamous monkeypox risk, you know, activity. I can't even talk about this. And the story goes away. But this slavery reparation thing was something that has not really been front and center. I think the left sees it, has seen it for a couple decades as a pretty bad idea. When I was a little kid, it was mentioned by some groups, but it was sort of like, you know, this is not going to go anywhere. It's not a good idea. This seems to be something that's had a little staying power in California. I don't think it has nationally. I think Liz Warren and maybe Bernie, I can't remember, brought it up. But Biden has not really wanted to touch it a lot. And you always know a president doesn't want to go near something when what do? They put a commission.
Yeah, study around, it.
You know, that's a good way to kill something.
Yes.
But in California, they seem to kind of really be hot on this thing.
Well, here's the key, I think. You're right. And it may be that this is because so far the task force, which was set up under an assembly bill Newsom signed off on in 2020, this commission, this task force, has only met in, I think, you know, relatively small number of regional meetings and then released this 500-page report. And then the subsequent kind of headline story that came out of it was that African-American descendants of African Americans in the 19th century are owed $223,000. That caught people's attention. That was the first real concrete thing. That 500-page report, by the way, is just, it's diabolically dumb. It is a confusion of dumb racist theory, racial theories, you know, like CRT and that sort of thing, along with deliberate confusions of what went on in the U.S. and globally with regard to slavery. And you know, what didn't happen in California, or the relatively small numbers of victims of racism, or I should say systemic racism and slavery in the 19th century. It's just it's a bad, bad document. Here's the catch. This document now goes to the legislature, and the legislature will consider action on the commission's proposals, including this figure of $223,000 as a cash payment. That's one of the proposals. The others are that we should just give money to programs that support black people. You can imagine that having wide appeal on the left, because that money will flow into organizations. It'll be like a trough. We're talking about $500 million. 2 years, more than 2 years of California budgets, 2.5 years of California budgets, basically annual budget expenses going into this one program, and it will flow into these nonprofits on the left And those organizations will use that money to advance any number of causes that have almost nothing to do with black poverty or the failures of black education, which we can ascribe to one of those institutions that will receive some of this money, and that's the California Teachers Association, who have been huge backers of the reparations panel and have claimed that this is the reason they're not able to educate black people is slavery. All right. I think the best local win, there were a number of great parents who ran for school board this year, but I think without a doubt, the best local win, the surprise win of the year for me, and I'd welcome any other suggestions on this, David, from you or from any of our listeners. The best local win was in February when the San Francisco School Board was recalled.
Local to them.
Local to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so local to us.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Our best local win is when the Newport Beach City Council race announced. City Council results were announced.
Tell me.
Well, it was wonderful.
Yes.
Every candidate we had that I think represents our position on these things won in Newport, and every candidate who did not lost, including one incumbent. But by far the bigger story statewide was San Francisco.
Yeah, statewide and national even. This story.
Oh, sure, that's right.
This story was in the BBC. And this is the you'll remember that the San Francisco School Board was under fire because during COVID, when they had locked all the kids out of school, especially harming I think 15,000 African American students in the district. This school board still found the time to purge the names of schools, school names that identified people they thought were associated with racism. One of the schools they went after was Dianne Feinstein Elementary. What was her crime? That at some one point when creating a museum for the city of San Francisco, she approved in a, you know, just sort of a, I can't remember what you call these things in city council meetings, just like a mess of expenditure items. One of the items was a Confederate flag for this museum that was supposed to show how Confederate Southern sympathizers had moved to the Bay Area in the 1850s. Pardon me, and had pushed for slavery. Not good enough. So her name had to go. They were going to eliminate, you might remember, murals that depicted very lefty perspectives of white colonialism in California, but had come to be seen as triggering to minority representatives, indigenous communities, etc. So they got involved in all this stuff, and it really ticked off parents whose kids were locked at home, that this is the best they could do with their time, the San Francisco School Board. So in a February election, three of the members, the only three who were eligible for recall, were recalled. Big, big story. And this was progressives leading this. This is Democrats leading this initiative. This was not a bunch of, you know, Koch-funded groups, as the left likes to complain. This was ordinary outraged parents. And I want to point out one special group, and that is the Asian American activists, who got Asian American votes exceeded about 90% of Asian American registered voters. More than 90% voted for this recall. It was a huge, huge turnout for the Asian American community in San Francisco.
Yep. Big story.
Under a heading I call Running with the Diablo, that's a Van Halen reference right there. Thank you. Yeah, sure.
Well done.
Governor Newsom extended the life of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant last summer, and the reason was that his all-electric future was collapsing and he needed Diablo Canyon to stay online. We had wildfires all over the place. The governor was allowing diesel generators to be kicked on in the ports of LA, Long Beach, San Francisco, and Oakland. That violated his own Clean Air Act, but he did it under emergency authority. Same for Diablo Canyon. He finally encouraged the legislature to allow him to keep it open, despite anti-nuclear lefty types who wanted to see it closed. And then he celebrated on November the 21st, this is just about a month ago, the announcement that Joe Biden's administration was going to send the state a desperately needed $1 billion to keep Diablo Canyon maintained and up. So again, I want to come back to the fact that this is a state that Newsom claimed just a few weeks ago had a $100 billion surplus, but couldn't find in its own pockets and seat cushions $1 billion to keep Diablo Canyon open, and so relied on the Biden administration to give up that cash to keep Diablo Canyon open. David, any thoughts on the rank hypocrisy here, the need for money from someplace else, the attack on nuclear and green energy?
Yeah, it packs a few different stories in one, because you have the hypocrisy, and I sometimes you know, I guess I'm maybe a little too numb to it. I get underwhelmed by stories of hypocrisy because I expect them and maybe I shouldn't. But then this has the massive environmental failure of California policy attached to the hypocrisy, attached to a demonstration of who the real victims are. So it does kind of combine a lot put together, and it enables you to tie it into a Van Halen reference. So there's a lot there.
June 30th, we finally got a decision from our own state Supreme Court. They would not hear an appeal by independent truckers in California to exempt them from the execrable AB 5, Assembly Bill 5. That was Lorena Gonzalez's bill. Lorena, who's now head of the California Federation of Labor and was a member of the Teamsters Union and wrote AB 5 to satisfy their need to make sure they could organize employees more easily. It was supposed to liberate, AB 5 was supposed to liberate workers in the gig industry who were operating as independent contractors by making them employees of companies like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash. When those companies in 2020 got an exemption from it, it really left just a few other people who were less able to protect themselves, including the state's 40,000 independent truckers. Here's what's fascinating about independent trucking, David. Well known that this is an industry dominated. Independent trucking is dominated by formerly low income, but now entrepreneurial and business owning minority people from South Asia. We got a lot of Indians involved in the business, a lot of Chinese, a lot of Latinos. And they value this step up the economic ladder. Imagine 40,000 small business owners. They invested in the cost of a new truck. These things can run anywhere from, you know, a very modest $150,000 for a truck upwards of $300,000, $350,000. These are not inexpensive capital investments. And with a sweep of his pen, Governor Newsom signs AB 5 and makes it impossible for truckers to be independent of the companies that hire them for a haul. This is so toxic in so many ways. It, first of all, just eliminates with a pen stroke the independent businesses of 40,000 people by declaring them not really independent businesses. It increases corporate ownership. It now means that if you want to be a trucker in California, you have to be the employee of a large trucking corporation. You have to be their employee. And that makes it easier for the unions to organize you, of course, because you are now an employee rather than a business owner. Who sees yourself as distinct from the factory class, if you will, or the industrial class. And then one of the worst things it did was this unanticipated but utterly predictable attack on the shipping industry, the logistics, the infrastructure, the supply chain, we have come to call it. So at a time when the U.S. is struggling...
Luckily, the supply chain was thriving, and it was a good time to experiment.
Perfect
on
time,
it.
Yeah. So we have at a time, you know, rail industry workers going on strike under Joe Biden. We have the trucking industry destroyed by Gavin Newsom and, you know, prices climbing high. This very nearly derailed, no pun intended, the entire Christmas holiday thing. But the most important impact, of course, is that it just destroys businesses, independently owned businesses in the trucking industry. And the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, refused to hear it. So there we go. We will now see the fallout from this in supply chain logistics problems. We will see the wipeout, the immoral destruction. I mean, this really does remind me of life under Stalin when he went to war with the kulaks, you know, the small farmers and any independent business owners. This is the state crushing small business. One of the big stories of the year. David, I think another big story for the year in abortion.
Mm-hmm.
In one day, in late September, Newsom signed 17 new abortion rights bills. One of those, one of the bills that he had signed earlier put Proposition 1 on the ballot. And that was the bill, you'll remember, yeah. David, that or the ballot measure that basically lifted the lid on any kind of limits on abortion in California, made it a constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big year for abortion. And I just thought that the governor's press release here on, let me see if I can find it here, new protections for people who need abortion care and birth control. This is out of the governor's office on September 27th. The bill package builds upon more than $200 million in state funding to create abortion.ca.gov. That's a new website for abortion providers. Cover uninsured care. That means free abortions. Support providers. That means that if you provide abortions, you are now in a special category, a special class of medical providers who deserve additional protections. It goes on and on and on. This is really prepping the ground, I think, for liberal votes in the United States. If he decides to run for the White House, he is going to run on abortion as one of his major issues, David.
Yeah, it's a voter enthusiasm thing with youth, maybe with some of the pre-married women. There's different demographics it resonates with more. It also presupposes an old Democratic coalitional political assumption I'd be careful about. It presupposes that they're rock solid already with African American and Hispanic. Now, of course, they are from a majority standpoint. But the difference between a Democrat, let's say in a high-profile national race like, I don't know, the presidency, getting 94% of the African-American vote and getting 80% of the African-American vote, that's the difference between winning and losing. And on the margin, now the big vulnerability we've seen since the Hispanic vote really went towards Obama and away from Mitt Romney was that the Republicans are at risk of permanently losing that brown vote, and that that would be another arsenal in the Democrat coalition and make it very hard for them to lose, and that now there's a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth because that is not the case. And Ron DeSantis has done so well with brown voters in Florida, for example, and even just around the country. Mm-hmm. There's a sense in which in states like Texas, Arizona, immigration policies are not hurting Republicans. The Hispanic vote's largely, again, on the margin, moving closer to the numbers they had during the W. Bush administration, which were much higher. I'm not sure the abortion issue carries well with the Hispanic and African-American voters the way it does with people that I would assume are already in their camp. So I think it's an enthusiasm play. It's a turnout play, which was necessary in midterms. But are there people who abortion's their number one voting issue and being in favor of it that were likely not going to vote for a Democrat already? I don't think so. I think this is not a move people over into your camp type issue. And so getting as radical as you can down the kind of all the way up to 9 months of pregnancy sleeve, I don't agree that it's the political wisdom of the day. I don't think it should be their political wisdom on their side. I think it's dangerous.
That's interesting because it's a, I think it's sort of the quote-unquote common sense view that abortion helped the Democrats among suburban women who might even be Republicans.
I don't know that that's a common sense view. I think it's common sense that it might have helped with independent women.
Okay.
And with youth vote. I'm not totally sold on it because I still just basically see Brian Kemp winning by 8 points and Herschel Walker losing by 2 points. At the end of the day, people can look and look and look. I'm an Occam's razor analyst at elections, and this was about Trump and bad candidates. But on the margin, if someone wanted to say that that there was a higher turnout of youth vote because of Dobbs, then I wouldn't argue with it. And if they wanted to say it was higher than you expected it would be, I wouldn't argue with it. That's fine. But that's a midterm. That's a midterm. It's hard to get turnout in midterms. Do I think in 2024, where turnout is through the roof, Americans don't have turnout problem anymore in elections? I would argue we made it way too easy to vote because I think too many uninformed people are voting, right, left, or center. I'm not a person who thinks the quantity of voting matters. I think the quality of voting matters. And I say that even if people voted differently than I wanted them to. I just want them to be informed. And I don't agree that our job is to try to get as many people that don't know anything about anything to go vote. But on this issue, do I think that the logic you're referring to or the consensus, if it is indeed accurate for 2022, is the same in 24? I don't.
Let's move on to the worst columnist in California. That would be the LA Times' Michael Hiltzik. For those who don't know him because you don't subscribe to the LA Times, read it in any way.
Or you're not a complete and total
masochist. Hiltzik is nominally on the business page, but he really seems like a minister without portfolio, opining on subjects he knows very, very little about, including the Assembly Bill 2098, which will take effect on January 1st. For those of you who don't follow acronymic bills, this is the Medical Misinformation Act that was designed to clamp down on COVID misinformation, but which, of course, views as quote-unquote misinformation anything which the state doesn't like. Now, The irony here is that Michael Hiltzik has written very recently in September that this is an issue that is absolutely necessary. It is necessary to crack down on medical misinformation, in part because this is a Republican effort to really disrupt the medical industry and to spread false rumors and to make it dangerous for people to go to their doctor because their doctor might be a Republican wacko Trump job who says you don't need to get the vaccine. He is especially worked up about vaccine denial in his column. Talks about, I'm totally blanking. Which Kennedy is this? It's Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an anti-vaxxer. He features him prominently in the piece and says, you know, this is the reason we need this government intervention to control medical information because doctors are saying whatever the hell they want and they're going off on crackpot ideas. I just like to point out to people that this is a guy with a very troubled past as a journalist, but you don't have to dig so far into his past to find all that great stuff. You can just look at his varying takes on the vaccine. We discussed this in the podcast, David. This is the guy who, when the vaccine first came out, Donald Trump was president, and his warning to the public at that point was the vaccine would kill you. He literally said, this is a death-dealing blow by the Trump administration. You should avoid the vaccine at all costs. Trump has rushed this thing into production only because he wants to get elected. He was saying all of this during the 2020 election. In the month before, in October of 2020, he is accusing people who are promoting the vaccine of being Trumpers. Then Trump loses. Biden gets into office. And as soon as Biden is in office, Hiltzik changes course, says the vaccine is absolutely so necessary that everybody should be compelled to get it, and anybody who denies it is evil and clearly a Republican. He has changed his politics, in other words, on the vaccine only because of who's in the White House. And he writes some pretty execrable stuff, including a piece in which he says, you know what, when people die of COVID because they did not get the vaccine, I'm saying because of, they die, they did not have the vaccine. He says, you know what? We ought to dance on their grave. We ought to celebrate this. It's a moral warning to everybody else that if you don't get the vaccine, you're likely to die from COVID. We have this, our own case in Orange County, where a fairly high profile district attorney, very young woman with kids, did not get the vaccine, celebrated her vaccine-free status, and then died of COVID at a relatively young age, David. I want to say she's like 42 or something.
I think she's in her late 40s, but either way, okay. In her 40s, yeah. Very young.
It was Hiltzik who celebrated and said that it was necessary to celebrate the death of these vaccine deniers. So I just want to say this is a guy who has been all over the map on science, but who constantly,
Yeah, so here's the thing, Will. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you need to tell me because you've studied this more. I'm with you 100%, but the question I have that I don't know the answer to is, did he acknowledge his turnabout?
No.
I don't think he did.
No, he never did.
And I think that having a turnabout is fine when you go, look, I used to say this, and now I'm saying this, and I know what it looks like, but I just want to put it right out there and say the difference is that Trump would have done this and this, but now we know the Biden administration really did this and this, and my view of the vaccine changed.
Nope.
And the this and this on both sides could be good points or bad points, but it's a sort of journalistic integrity and transparency. To have been an anti-vaxxer who now is we must vax or everyone will die, and you should die, and I hope you die, those views, I think, are rather appalling in a lot of different ways. But if you're going to switch your view, I think Andrew Sullivan's made this point about Bill Kristol. He goes, Bill Kristol, if you wanted to be one of the leading conservatives on this, this, and this, and now you're not, and if the reason is just because they nominated Trump and you're mad, fine, but you can't just change all your opinions on things like abortion that you've held for 30 years,
right,
on gun control for 40 years, and then not discuss it. Like, at least tell us what's up. And we can decide, because I don't have a problem if someone changes their mind.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think that's the weird part, is why not address it? Why not just say, hey, I think Will and Dave are going to talk about me on their podcast, and I just want to get in front of it and say they have no right to, because the only reason they changed their mind is because Trump was obviously politically opportunistic, and whereas the Biden administration showed a path of science.
Right, so right.
He could say it.
He could.
And we could all go like, oh, come on, dude.
Yeah.
But at least he was getting in front of it.
Right.
And to ignore it, to me, is the crime here.
It is. He just memory holes stuff. I mean, this is a guy who's
Can I give you an example?
Please.
There are people that said when we went to the COVID recession, because obviously they shut down the economy, economy drops, they go, oh, Trump has a recession here. Why, what do you mean recession? It's when there's two quarters in a row of negative GDP growth. That's what a recession is. Now we have recession. And we had a technical two-quarter of GDP negative earlier in the year, and it was obviously sort of an anomaly. Unemployment didn't go up. Corporate profits didn't go down. It was related to inventories. And so a lot of these journalists changed their mind. But Ben White at Politico came out and said, look, I said this before. Tucker Carlson's making fun of me. Now I'm saying something different, and he's right. But I want to get in front of this. This is why I changed my mind. When I said it before, I was wrong. I didn't understand that a recession technically is this and this, and NBR does that, and it has profits and other indicators. And now I did more homework, and so the answer's changed. And it looks like I'm being politically opportunistic, and I can't stop anyone from thinking that, but I acknowledge I said this before, I'm saying this now.
That's a mature
response. It's a mature thing to say. Yeah. And people could say, oh, screw you, you're still a hack, or they can say, okay, I respect it, whatever they want. But get in front of it. This guy should get in front of it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And I guess what's most deeply disturbing to me, and I'll just admit this, this is my pettiness. This is a guy who, when I came out and said, look, we should reopen classes. COVID is not killing small children. This is a disaster for them educationally. This is a guy who repudiated me, called me a right-wing hack and a Koch fund. I wish I were Koch funded. They accused us of being Koch funded and just radical Trump supporters.
I have a new rule, by the way, for the Kochs.
What's that?
If anyone on the right gets accused of being Koch funded and they're not Koch funded, the Kochs have to fund. You got to make it right.
From
just like true up the ledger.
I think you're right.
We just took the flack of being associated with you. Now pay me.
Yes, exactly. I would love that.
Hey. No, I think that dude is the worst journalist in America.
Thank you. Wow, that's a lot. I was just claiming for California, but that's big. I like it. Because I could go for...
I'm sorry, America. I meant the United States. So, if my kids ever want to go to Stanford
you got to clear that one up.
If my kids want to go to Stanford, that would be a fun conversation. Dad, I want to go to Stanford.
No.
First of all, no way, they're liberal. Also, you are so stupid.
They tell me all the time that you call them stupid when I'm talking them in it.
Oh, we can't say stupid either.
No, you can't. That's prohibited by Stanford.
I did forgot about that.
Your kids are screwed. Hey, my favorite column of the year, I swear, is by a guy named Joe Matthews. It was his piece in which he wrote, if you want true equality, I propose modestly forcing California parents to swap children. It was.
Oh, yeah.
Remember this one?
Yeah, but I still think he was joking.
He was joking. It's right in the headline. I propose modestly, a modest proposal. Jonathan Swift, right? He was proposing something totally absurd in the vein of Jonathan Swift, the great social
critic. I'm saying a lot of people didn't know he was joking.
No, that's true. A huge number of people said this is an outrage. Now, here's what he said. Let's start there. The left's promises, I'm throwing in the word the left, he doesn't say that. The promise of newly equitable systems are no match for the power of parents. Fathers and mothers with greater wealth, education, and other resources are more likely to transfer these advantages to their children, compounding privilege over generations. As a result, children of less advantaged parents face an uphill struggle. Social mobility has stalled and democracy has been corrupted. More Californians are giving up on the dream. A recent poll found declining belief in the notion that you can get ahead through hard work. My solution is simple. And while we wait for the legislation to pass, we can act now. The rich should give their children to the poor, and the poor should give their children to the rich. Homeowners might even swap children with their homeless neighbors. Now, this is obviously a joke, but it is a joke in the Babylon Bee style. It takes something which is inarguably true about the left, which is they're constantly searching for equity, but will not, absolutely will not countenance something like this. It was the lefties who jumped in on this and said they were most outraged, and I would argue that some conservatives failed to get the joke as well. David, any thoughts on my favorite column of the year?
Yeah, no, that is up there. I would like to say that my favorite column of the year would have been anything Gavin Newsom wrote or said related to moving to the center.
I love it.
There was a sort of 4-month theme going on there of just like, look, we're getting a lot of control here with the border. What were some of his? He never really did center out on environment.
No. Well, he did because he kept Diablo Canyon open.
There's that. Right.
He was endorsing a desalination plant, even though
One thing? It wasn't on abortion, but there was another where he just.
He had a boiler
about union. Oh, no. It was the stance against Remember the unions were mad.
The farm workers.
And he was trying to triangulate there.
Yes. Yeah. What he was doing there was saying that farm workers should not give up their right to a secret vote. Well, the government unions and, of course, the UFW, United Farm Workers, and Joe Biden wanted all votes in future by farm workers to be made public. No more secret vote. That way the union organizer and your thuggish colleagues can leer at you while you go vote and make sure that you have voted appropriately. You are correct. Moderate Newsom may be the most interesting new animal of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Well, David, that's all the time we have today. We wish everybody a happy new year. We'll be back in just a few days to discuss with you what's coming up in 2023, but that's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but please subscribe and rate and review the show. You can email us comments and story suggestions. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bunsen, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, our researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian, and all of our friends at National Review. We thank you too, especially National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.